Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. We have a big show today. We have Josh Merz, candidate for Kentucky Treasurer. This is his fourth appearance on my Old Kentucky Podcast. That's kind of amazing.
It is. He has the record now.
He has a record. Kara Stewart, you're out there listening. You know, you gotta come back on. All right, but we have tons of stuff to get to before that. We're going to start off by talking about the end of the election challenge in the 13th District in Owensboro. Jasmine's going to tell us a little bit about some hot water that Ralph Alvarado, candidate for lieutenant governor, finds himself inside of. We are going to talk a little bit about Marcy's Law, which has just had an oral argument in front of Skokie. We are going to talk about Louisville's No Good, Very Bad Week. And then we are going to have another new segment, Good Bill and Bad Bill, two bills that we want to highlight from the General Assembly, and we're going to probably do this every week from until the end of the session, talking about bills in front of the Assembly. And then we have just a few quick hits. So that's a ton of stuff to get to. So Jasmine, without any further ado, let's talk about the 13th District. Jasmine, this one ended in a surprising way.
It did.
Where there were eyeball emojis. I think it's a joke now, but I think I sent that to you with the eyeballs emoji.
Yeah, you did.
So on Friday, the 9-member House body in charge of the recount met to hear from the Daviess County Clerk's Office, where the recount had just recently occurred. And the lawyers for Jim Glenn, who is the seated representative who won by a single vote, and DJ Johnson, who's the former representative who called for the recount. So they were both there. They were talking. Glenn's side made clear that he would not accept a coin flip or a similar type of select mechanism to remove him from office.
I think that's fair, because this isn't a situation where it was a tie before the votes were certified. Mm-hmm. He's been certified and seated.
Right.
So I'd be mad if there was a coin flip to like impeach me.
Remove. You know? Yeah, absolutely. To get your name off the list. And yeah, absolutely. I can understand where he's coming from that. And then after that, after Jim Glenn and his lawyers made clear they did not want to be removed in that way, they would not accept that, DJ Johnson made a statement. And in that statement, he said, quote, "What's best for my people and my community is that we end this," unquote. And then he asked to withdraw his challenge. The 9-member panel promptly disbanded, and now Representative Glenn will remain the representative for the rest of the term. So it just, hey, you know what? This is bad. I'm tired of it. I guess it's over.
The end.
Yeah. And you know, also saying, you know, this is best for my community. I don't want to drag them through the mud here, which, you know, that's nice. I think that that's something that can be appreciated by everybody. So Johnson's statement highlighted, that what was best for him was a coin flip that would give him a chance to win. But that since Glenn would not accept that, the resulting turmoil in Owensboro was not worth his challenge. And he said, Johnson said he did not want to put his community through such a thing. So Jasmine, the thing is, based on all the evidence available to us, at least to me, which, you know, I'm dealing with news reports and following this pretty closely, it appeared to me that more people absolutely voted for Jim Glenn than DJ Johnson. The tied recount to me was a bit of a farce, if only because of that single ballot that had Republican Party like struck out and partly bubbled in, which the Daviess County Clerk Office inexplicably counted for DJ Johnson. We didn't talk about that last week, except for I had to insert a secret into the show. Have you seen the ballot?
No.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about this last week.
Right. And I was on the side of this seems not legit, and you were like, no, it seems legit.
I think the way that it was described as like, hey, this ballot was a little bit unclear, but it looked like they tried to vote for a straight party Republican, that seemed above board to me. But then I saw the ballot, and it was like a third of the way bubbled in with a strike through the entire Republican Party. And they were like, oh, yeah, they're probably trying to vote straight ticket Republican. And the fact that the Republican Party has the clerk's office there in Daviess County, and then eventually Jim Glenn's lawyers moved to sue. They said that the lawyer for Johnson stopped being, you know, an observer and asked them to count that ballot. So that part was not legit in my mind. You know, Jasmine, this is the thing. I'm still incredibly unclear about the legality of any of what happened.
I think we all are.
Okay, so just to recap the entire process, the election occurred and the unofficial counts showed that Jim Glenn won by one vote. The Secretary of State did a re-canvass of the vote, which everyone is entitled to, and they made no changes to the total. The Secretary of State office certified the election. DJ Johnson wanted to do a recount and made the claim that the only way to recount an election for state representative was to appeal directly to the legislature. And to this very day, I have no idea whether or not that's the case. I've heard some people say, no, he could have done something different. And Republicans seem uniformly to say, no, this is the only way to do a recount for state representative. So honestly, no clue. Still no idea. Okay, in order to appeal to the legislature clearly needed to be in session. And so when the session started, there was some controversy, but they did indeed seat Jim Glenn. The process laid out in the statute, which was randomly selecting 9 members of the House, did occur, and we landed with 6 Republicans and 3 Democrats. The committee asked the Daviess County Clerk's Office to conduct a recount at DJ Johnson's expense. The county clerk recounted the vote, and based on a new hand count of the ballots, Jim Glenn won by 3. And that included in that winning by 3 was that new ballot that had, you know, not initially been counted for DJ Johnson, but was only like slightly bubbled in with a strike through it. So Glenn probably should have been leading by 4. The county clerk's office then decided to count 5 absentee ballots that had previously been disqualified. That's the part I think they probably should have done. I think if somebody made an effort to vote, we should count those. The result, though, after that was a tie, but again, should have ended with Jim Glenn winning by 1.
Which is right, the original result.
Right. I do think it's worth it, though, that there would have been, you know, 5 more votes in the election. The county clerk reported back to the 9-member panel, and that panel heard from the lawyers. When deciding what to do next, Glenn said he would not accept being removed by a coin flip, which prompted DJ Johnson to withdraw his challenge. And that's the whole story. So Jim Glenn's going to serve this term. Jasmine, I think DJ Johnson, though, we have not heard the end of him.
Yeah, I think we might see this battle
again
in a few years.
He did say he has kept his yard signs. So there you go. We will probably see DJ Johnson running again. It will be like the Toby Harold Cluster Howard, fight back and forth probably. So that's the end of the 13th District saga. Jasmine, tell us about Ralph Alvarado.
All right. So Tom Loftus of the Courier-Journal published an article last week detailing a 2015 settlement that sort of involves Senator Ralph Alvarado, Bevin's new running mate. The lawsuit alleged that Alvarado received illicit gifts while referring Medicare patients to a home health agency in Lexington.
Right.
The U.S. Attorney's Office said that there was evidence that he'd receive $12,000 in campaign contributions over a 6-year period, 2 UK basketball tickets, tickets to a coach's night, and an edible arrangement.
Now, you know what? I was like, no big deal, no big deal, no big deal. But then seeing the edible arrangement, this is serious stuff.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's some serious stuff. That's absolutely very serious.
So Alvarado is not actually a defendant in this lawsuit. This is a lawsuit against companies called Nurses Registry and Home Health Corporation. And the suit alleges violations of the False Claims Act. So the False Claims Act is a federal law that makes it a crime to make a false record or false claim regarding a federal healthcare program. Mm-hmm. No one was actually charged criminally. This was actually came out of a whistleblower suit filed by 2 former Nurses Registry employees, but then the federal government intervened, alleging the FCA violation. Gotcha. So that's why the U.S. Attorney's Office was involved to begin with.
Okay.
Specifically, it alleged that Lenny House, who's the former owner of Nurses Registry, distributed tickets and money to 24 different doctors to induce them to refer Medicare patients to Nurses Registry, and many of whom got a lot more than Alvarado did. Mm-hmm. So it kind of varied. The case settled for $16 million, so I do think it had some teeth. There probably wasn't just nothing to it if it settled for $16 million. It was settled by Mr. House's widow. He actually passed away while it was still pending. Alvarado has said that the lawsuit has nothing to do with him, and this is just, you know, a smear campaign, essentially. And he's right in the sense that he was not a named defendant in the lawsuit, but he is someone who received some benefits in exchange for referring patients to this registry.
He essentially illicit acts that he might have been involved in were part of a case against someone else.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, yeah, you wouldn't be part of the lawsuit at that point, but that doesn't mean you didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
Well, and I don't know, Jasmine, I've worked in and around doctor's offices my whole career, and this sort of stuff, I mean, pharmacists too, this sort of stuff is absolutely par for the course. They get all kinds of weird
right,
gifts
like
and
this,
stuff.
This seemed, it's not good, it's not right, but it almost seems like this kind of thing happens, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, it is wrong. And I mean, clearly, the federal government said this was one that crossed the line. They settled for $16 million. And I mean, that's the thing. The line's pretty blurry, but whoever was in charge here definitely blew past it. And it's hard to say, you know, if their campaign to blow past it included Alvarado, but they did, you know, solicit him in
right.
what they're trying to do.
And the in the whistleblower suit, what they were alleging is that Nurses Registry had this whole like job position of a communications person, that this was their whole job to like solicit these gifts and mm-hmm. tickets and things like that. Yeah. It's not great. Ralph Alvarado says it's nothing, but it's something. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Certainly, it is an indictment of the idiocy in the American healthcare system. But yeah, probably not good for Ralph Alvarado either. All right, Jasmine, tell us about Marcy's Law.
All right, we're back with Marcy's Law for, I don't know how many times we've talked about it, but it's been quite a bit. But Marcy's Law went to Skokie last week. Last week, Skokie heard oral arguments in the Marcy's Law case. Going back a little bit, you'll remember the trial court held that the ballot question was too vague so that the votes cast in November could not be certified. So they could be counted, and about 63% of people did vote yes for Marcy's Law, but they just couldn't be certified by the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Six justices heard oral arguments, so we don't have seven because Justice Bill Cunningham just retired, so
right.
It could end in a tie. But oral arguments, you know, there aren't a lot of new arguments that we haven't talked about, but the attorney defending Marcy's Law said that the voters already knew the contents of the law when they voted on the ballot. She argued that there was a big campaign on both sides, so the voters were already informed, even though the ballot question didn't, you know, include the contents of the statute. She said the entire amendment was on all kinds of websites and it was handed out to citizens at public forums. And though it did get quite a lot of publicity, I just don't agree with it.
Well, that's kind of like goes against what ballot questions are supposed to be about. Why don't you just, at that point, just put like, yes or no, this bill you clearly know everything about, you know?
Right. And she argued that it's not required that the statute be listed on the ballot question. And that's correct. But I do think this was pretty vague. And while there was a huge campaign for Marcy's Law, I mean, we had celebrities like Kelsey Grammer on commercials, I don't think that people knew what the law contained.
Sure.
She also said it wasn't misleading because the question stated the essential purpose and character of mm-hmm. what the amendment would look like. I was a big fan of Justice Keller's response about the ballot question. She said, if you ask the voters if they're for crime victims' rights, who other than a sociopath is going to answer anyway but yes to that question?
Well, what did you answer to that question, Jasmine? I mean, I answered no. So
I mean, I answered no, and so did 37% of people.
Yeah.
A couple justices did have questions, you know, about whether one sentence on a ballot is sufficient to explain 10 new constitutional rights.
That is a good question. And
right. And I think that's a part of this. This amendment
is huge.
Is pretty big, and it would be a huge shift in what constitutional rights regarding, you know, criminal justice are. There were also questions about whether it's even necessary because we have a Crimes Victim Bill of Rights in the Kentucky Revised Statute. That's what I've been saying.
It is,
right?
It's what you've been saying. It's what I heard you say, and then I told other people. Yeah.
Yeah. Justice Hughes said, if this passes muster, what happens next time when it's a seemingly equally simple question that's going to wheelbarrow into the Constitution a number of things that are not presented? So I think this is, you know, a good case to go before Skokie because mm-hmm. we could, if this passes, what could we put on the ballot in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Justice Van Meter said that people could have abstained from voting if it was too vague. So I think maybe Justice Van Meter is leaning on the side that maybe it's okay. But it's not a question of whether the question itself is vague. It's that it's vague about what the law contains,
right?
And so I don't think that people know. I think people understood what the question was. They just didn't know what the law contained. So
right.
It's not that, are you for crime victims?
You know,
I don't think anyone was confused by mm-hmm. the question itself and would think, that doesn't make sense. I'll just leave it blank. So
right.
I don't think that's the right way of looking at it.
The people that don't know they're uninformed, would have no clue. Like the people that aren't that are uninformed wouldn't understand it. If you just see a ballot question that's like, do you support crime victims' rights, and you didn't know anything about it, you'd be like, well, yeah, Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. Exactly.
Like Justice Keller said, only a sociopath
right.
wouldn't say yes.
Right.
So oral arguments have been heard. Now we wait on Skokie to rule, and we don't know when that'll be. If it's a tie, however, then the trial court's lower ruling just stands.
Right.
So
there you go.
That's where we are with Marcy's Law.
Yeah. This does also make me think of one thing. And that's, you know, a lot of amendments, especially to like the United States Constitution. I don't know if this is necessarily true of Kentucky, which has more amendments than the U.S. Constitution, I think. But they're pretty short most of the time. And I think that, you know, if you think about Marcy's Law and they're like, this thing addresses too many things, it would be really difficult to list all of those. That's a good indication that it may be not appropriate to have one constitutional amendment that addresses all those issues. So, I mean, I don't know. That's just my opinion on it.
I think we'll know from this case what ballot questions might need to look like in the future,
mm-hmm.
If this passes or if it's struck down. So now we just wait for Skokie to rule.
There you go. They come out on like Tuesdays or something, right?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't know. I think that's right. Don't hold me to it, though. All right, Jasmine, I also want to talk about Louisville's no good, very bad week. So two very bad things happened in Louisville this week. The city learned that the hole created by the new pension requirements will require $65 million to fill, and Google Fiber left the city.
Both bad.
Both are bad. So first, let's talk a little bit about the pension situation. So as part of changes made to the assumptions about how much pension funding would be needed, we've talked about the board that makes those assumptions and their shift in accounting at length throughout the show. Cities are now required to have pension contributions that have increased substantially. This was something that people were worried about. There was a bill to cap those increases, but yeah, it's still a substantial increase for cities like Louisville. So this week, the Fisher administration announced a slate of cuts that could be necessary to be able to fill the $65 million that will be owed over the next 4 years. So here's a list of what those cuts could be. Among them, closing one library branch.
No.
Yes, that's
I love the library.
I know you love the library. Closing four public pools. There are only five total. Closing two fire stations, closing four golf courses, and making cuts to nearly every department on top of that.
I guess I don't have that much of a problem with the golf courses, but
there are people who do. Yeah,
seem important. Libraries are important.
Pools.
The public pools, those are great to have in the summer, and if you only have one, that seems crowded.
Yeah, that's not great. Pools are great. Golf courses are great. These are incredible municipal utilities that are used by lots and lots of people. Having them is good. I think that we should try to keep them. So another plan that would avoid a lot of these cuts is to increase taxes, which, hey, how novel, change the demand side and increase the amount of money you have. So the city has floated the idea of raising the tax on insurance premiums. Right now, the tax on insurance premiums brings in about 10% of the revenue for the city and is levied at 5% of insurance premiums, which then almost always get passed on to the consumer. Or the worker, I guess, in this case. The proposal that has been reported is a doubling of that tax to 10%. So this tax would fall on people who get insurance from their employers who work in Louisville, which, you know, it's difficult to say what's graduated and not for something like this, but people mm-hmm. who get insurance through their employers tend to be a little bit better off than people who don't. So this tax may or may not, I mean, that's one way to look at it. This tax might fall on people who are a little bit more well off than people who don't get insurance through their job. So maybe. I don't know. So several Metro Council members from both sides of the aisle spoke to Philip Bailey of the Courier-Journal and complained about the Fisher administration's handling of this issue. They include Jessica Green, who is no friend of the mayor. She represents West and Southwest Louisville, just kind of a strip along the western part of Louisville along the river. Brett Ackerson, also no friend of the mayor, who represents kind of West Butchel. And I wrote this down, right, Jasmine? I said, that part of St. Matthews that you always forget is actually St. Matthews. You know what I'm talking about?
What part is that?
Like the part that's like north of Butchel that kind of isn't on Shelbyville Road.
Like Breckenridge Lane?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
That's where my parents live.
There you go.
So I know that it's part of St. Matthews.
Okay, so that's Brett Ackerson. Brett Ackerson actually spoke out against the mayor in a separate interview. It's like a lot of people piled on in this first interview, and then Brett Ackerson was like, I got to get mine in as well a day later. The Republicans that spoke out against Fisher were Anthony Piagentini. I think that's how you say that. He's brand new. He's a freshman. He's in Middletown. He's actually Hal Heiner's old district, if you are familiar with him. Kevin Kramer, who represents parts of J-Town. One word that was used by these folks was ambush. It said that they were unaware of the need for these cuts and that the mayor's office should have been talking about this more. Maybe these people should have been listening to my old Kentucky podcast. That would have been...
They should.
Yeah, they would have known a little bit about more about what was coming. But I do think that the complaints that these people filed do have some merit to them. I think that they're more around the level of community engagement. So in order to pass this tax, it would need to be done by March, which leaves only a small number of weeks to hear from the community about impacts of cuts to service or increased taxes. I mean, that's a big decision to make. Do you want to make these huge cuts or do you want to increase taxes? Neither one of those is a good thing. And you really probably want to hear from your constituents about which strategy is better. The thought is that there was, you know, a commitment to discussion about things like the Castleman statue and the homeless encampments, which, you know, we've been talking about the Castleman statue for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we only have 6 weeks to decide whether or not to have this massive tax increase or to have these really draconian cuts to services. And I think that's fair. But at the same time, you know, these problems were foisted to Louisville by Frankfurt. And there probably was enough time to have this discussion a little bit earlier, but not too much. So in short, Frankfurt created a huge hot mess, and Greg Fisher maybe could have handled it a little better. So there you go.
And I think Louisville is in such a tough position all the time because we're putting all this money into the state and sometimes not getting much back from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lexington did not have a similar issue because they're not actually part of the KRS system. You know, maybe maybe time to get the heck out of Dodge, maybe, if you're Louisville, if you're thinking about it at
least.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, but the other bad thing that happened in Louisville is that Google Fiber just decided to up and leave.
This really came out of nowhere.
The Fisher administration exerted a significant amount of effort to get Google Fiber to come to Louisville. They passed, you know, the One Touch Make Ready law, which we've talked about on the show, and they defended that law in court. And you know, they also had a significant lobbying campaign when Google Fiber said, we're looking for other cities to go to. Louisville was like, we will do whatever it takes to get you to come here. So Google Fiber actually arrived in Louisville with significant fanfare. Jasmine, did you get one of those T-shirts that said, you know, make the internet something?
No, I remember them, but
yeah.
I don't have one.
Yeah, I don't know what mine says, but I think I have it somewhere. But there was not much infrastructure that Google ever built in the city of Louisville. So as part of the agreement when Google Fiber came to Louisville, Google committed to bring their technology to Portland, which is a community that could use some more investment. I think everybody can agree upon that. Google also decided to start in Strathmore Village in the Highlands and in Newburgh, which is a little bit south. It's like south of Strathmore Village. Mm-hmm. So when the work started, they opted to use something called micro-trenching to bury their cables. Instead of digging like a deep hole and burying fiber cable under the ground, they dug like a much smaller hole within the pavement on the road. That method allowed for faster laying of cable, but it also created significant outages and problems with the service. So basically what happened, they cut into the road, they dropped the fiber down into it, and of course when it rains, or in Kentucky where we have, you know, snow and stuff, the roads contract and expand, and that's how we get potholes in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that happened right over where the cables were. So they cut all the time, which caused them to have some significant service problems. And Google eventually said that in order to stay in Louisville, they would need to rebuild their entire infrastructure. And, quote, that's just not the right business decision for us, unquote. So, Jasmine, at the end of the day, it wasn't ever really clear where Google even laid the fiber. They definitely did in Strathmore Village. I live across the street. I live across Bardstown Road. I technically live in Strathmore Village, but I live in the part that they didn't put Google Fiber, which I was really mad about until about last week.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And according to Grace Simrall of the Louisville Office of Performance Improvement, Google did not notify Louisville until the day before they made the announcement that they were leaving. And there really wasn't anything that the city could do at that point. They basically said, we're leaving. There's nothing you can do about it. We are sorry. So, Google's blog post about the elimination of Louisville service make it seem like Louisville is more of a test market where they were running like experiments, which really rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I thought that we'd made some serious investments and really wanted them to come here. And they were like, yeah, well, we tried some stuff. Didn't work. So sorry, it's not going to work out.
Right.
Which is really crappy. So since Google Fiber moved to town, though, AT&T and Spectrum have made significant increases, investments in their fiber offerings. So, I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of people say Google Fiber exists just to get more fiber into the world. And if that is the case, they might have been successful on that level.
AT&T Fiber still hasn't made it to my neighborhood.
It's made it to mine. I think I might actually make the switch.
I used to have it in Clifton and was very happy with it. So I'm waiting for it to come to Linden.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was kind of waiting for Google Fiber to make it across the street because it still would be cheaper. But yeah, I guess I'll get AT&T on the phone. Jasmine, I want to do a different segment today that we have not done before. It is the session. We haven't really talked too much because there hasn't been too much going on. There's been a lot of committee votes. The Senate's actually voted on some stuff, but nothing's fully passed. But I wanted to do a thing called Good Bill, Bad Bill. I need a better name for that. But that's what we're going with today, where we highlight one good bill that's going through the legislature that we would like to see passed, and one bad bill that we really think is bad and we shouldn't have passed. So, Jasmine, the good bill I want to highlight today is HB 41. The chief sponsor is Joni Jenkins, and co-sponsors are Mackenzie Cantrell and Josie Raymond.
Those are some of our favorite people.
Yeah, great people. Here's the bill's summary as it's written. So it requires employers to give employees a written good faith estimate of the employee's work schedule at the time of hire, maintain a voluntary standby list of employees who wish to work additional hours, post weekly work schedules at least 7 days in advance, and provide certain rest periods for employees during which the employee is not scheduled, provided that an employee may identify time limitations for scheduling work hours, establish the rate of compensation to be paid if an employer changes the schedule.
This all sounds like great common sense stuff.
It does. But there are some people who are like, why is this necessary? And is this going to hamstring business owners and employers? And that's, you know, something that's worth talking about, probably. So this is what's called a fair scheduling bill. Fair scheduling laws have been popping up all over the country. Most of the places that have enacted them are major cities like New York, Seattle, and San Francisco. But the whole state of Oregon has also adopted this reform. So the reason why these things are increasing in popularity is that they are a reaction to an increasing amount of control that employers are exhibiting over their workers' schedules. So, Jasmine, I am a data scientist. That's my day job. and I know from my job that it's certainly possible to predict with very high accuracy the need for workers in very small windows of time. So, you know, armed with this information, employers can actually reduce their labor costs by adjusting worker schedules in response to their need for work. You could be like, you only are working like this 1 or 2 hour period because that's when we need a lot of extra help. You know, we actually don't need you this like 15 minute period or something. You need to clock out. We need you to be available to work during this day so we can call you to come in, but we're only going to pay you if you work. And if you're not available, we're going to fire you and all that sort of stuff as started to happen across the country. Some companies have actually also started requiring their staff to call in every day, so you don't even know when you're working until the day of, and that's when you learn your schedule. So I worked an hourly job for a long time. That would have been horrible. This is a disaster for workers, like this system.
Right.
Reduced labor costs are great for companies, but it means lower paychecks.
I had an hourly job that I would get scheduled like 3 days a week, and then I would have 2 on-call days a week, and you wouldn't really know until about 4 o'clock,
right,
if you needed to go in.
That's not great. That's not really a job. You know, that's like, hey, we're going to make you do something and not pay you for it. So, okay. With the advent of work requirements for all sorts of state and federal programs, small shifts in schedules could result in like losing your Medicaid or SNAP benefits. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's another big issue here. So, Jasmine, here's the thing. It's the job of businesses to maximize their profits. We live in a capitalist system. That's what they do. It's immoral to treat workers like this, but it's certainly how our economy incentivizes businesses to act. So in a system like ours, it's in order to deal with this issue, you regulate the business. And that's what this law does. Of course, not all businesses utilize precision scheduling techniques like these, and enforcing predictable schedules do put a burden on industry. You know, we probably should say that. That's something that businesses aren't liking. And if you are, you know, running a construction agency and you have your same schedule that's been working there for like 100 years or whatever, and you're like, hey, I typically don't pay my workers when it rains, this is bad for me. I get that. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But there is enough stuff in the world that necessitates some sort of reform around schedules. The world has changed, and workers are really catching the brunt on this. So I think that this specific bill is a good one. I don't think it's going to pass, but I do think scheduling reform is something we need in Kentucky and across the country in terms of making sure that workers are able to, you know, continue to maintain their eligibility for programs that they need to eat or get health care. And, you know, just so that they can have steady paychecks, that they can know how much money they're
right. And I feel like this would help businesses, you know, retain quality employees too, probably.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a benefit of it, even though there's certainly a burden that comes with it.
Certainly. All right, Jasmine, the bad bill I want to highlight is Senate Bill 100. Its sole sponsor is Brandon Smith. Okay, so Jasmine, Senate Bill 100 is the net metering bill, and I'm not going to read the entire summary for this one because it's much longer than the summary
okay.
for the fair scheduling one. So,
good, I'm glad.
So essentially, we saw a similar bill last year with House Bill 227. That one was sponsored by Jim Gooch and four other House Republicans, plus Jeff Greer, who actually lost his re-election, but he was a Democrat, so it was bipartisan last year. So the bill, HB 227, last year, that made it through the House on a 49-45 vote. There were 30 floor amendments filed for this bill, but it died in the Senate despite making it out of committee. We talked about this bill a good amount last year. Kelly Flood was one of the main people who was opposed to it and spoke out very strongly about it. So this bill, Senate Bill 100, would make solar net metering a lot less attractive in Kentucky. So right now, Kentucky's solar net metering program allows for anybody with up to a 30-kilowatt-hour system to have a bi-directional meter set up for their home, which means that as you produce solar electricity, your meter actually runs backwards, and your bill is based on the net of how your meter runs, both backwards and forwards, based on the energy you produce and the energy that you consume. This bill would change the way that the net is actually calculated. So right now you have like one price that you both buy and sell electricity at, and it's the retail price. What this bill would do is say you're always buying electricity at the retail price, but the electricity that you sell back to the grid is actually priced at the price that the utility can buy it for. So, you know, obviously right now the system is such that if you are producing solar electricity, you're getting paid actually a little bit higher. You know, obviously utilities have overhead and such that they have to pay. You're getting paid a little bit higher than what the power company can actually buy the energy for. And this would mean that essentially you just get paid less. This makes the program a lot less attractive. So this process would be instantaneous, and that also means that the energy sold at night would be cheaper and that energy sold during the day would be more expensive. Anyways, the upshot is just that, you know, net metering participants would get less money off their electricity bills than they would otherwise. So Jasmine, while utilities are monopolies, they actually have limited ability to set price. This means that they often operate with thinner margins than you might think. And net metering does hurt the economic bottom line of many utilities, and they are generally supportive of these type of changes to net metering bills. So that's like why this is happening.
Right.
So Matt Party Miller, who's the president of the Kentucky Solar Energies Association, he wrote an op-ed about SB 100 in the Herald Leader, and he laid out the components he thought any compromise legislation should include. So the solar energy is coming with like saying this is what we need to do to have a fair compromise. So he says that the Kentucky Public Service Commission should conduct a study of post-net metering tariff rates. The second thing he said is that there should basically be like one way that we determine the rate. So not an individual case where you're like, hey, this one person has one price and this one person has a different price. There needs to be like one unhindered PSC administration case in determining the rate. The third thing he says is the aggregation of meters on the same property and owned by the same owner should be allowed, which is something else that they want to get rid of, and that leasing should be allowed. So you should be able to lease solar and lease the meter to help low-income Kentuckians participate more easily in this program.
The leasing option definitely sounds like something that would be helpful.
Yeah. They are racing this bill through the legislature. It has already passed the Senate, and today, Bam Carney, who's in the Republican leadership in the Senate, he's waived one of the major ways. He's made it a lot faster to get this legislation through. So they are working really hard to get this passed. It's already gone through the Senate. The House is dealing with it now. We'll see if the Democrats and, you know, believers in solar are able to get this thing stopped or changed so that we could have a little bit more of a compromise around solar net metering in Kentucky.
I'm glad that you're always here to explain the net metering bills, because I have to relearn what it is every year, and you're great at explaining.
Well, thanks, Jasmine. All right, I know that we're getting a little long on this side, but before we get to Josh Mers, there's two quick hits I want to get to. Senator Damon Thayer introduced legislation reforming the authority of the Secretary of State's office over the State Board of Elections. This move would take the Board of Elections in a more nonpartisan direction and would create more input from county clerks. It's, of course, in response to the reporting from the Herald Leader and ProPublica about Allison Undergan Grimes. I don't think it's too bad of a bill, even though Senator Damon Thayer is the one that came up with it. I do think more nonpartisanship in the State Board of Elections. I think it might go a little too far, but I think on the whole, it's pretty good. But I do think they should do the same thing to the LRC.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the other thing. And then lastly, Jasmine, you might have read about this. The U.S. Senate has passed, and the U.S. House is expected to pass, a massive land conservation bill that would protect 1.3 million acres as wilderness and do a bunch of other things. Included, so that you might have read that. That was a big story in national news last week. But included in those other things is that there will be two new national monuments in Kentucky, which will be operated by the National Park Service. They are Camp Nelson, which is one of the largest recruiting areas for African-American soldiers during the Civil War, and that's near Nicholasville, and the Mill Springs Battlefield, which is the site of a Civil War battle where the Union won and nearly 150 people died, and that's in Pulaski County near Somerset. We actually talked briefly about Senator McConnell and Representative Rogers' attempts to preserve Mill Springs back in May. I think it was actually a show that you missed. So, yeah, they were able to get that across the finish line, and there is now National Park Service working on that. So go visit those things.
Absolutely.
All right, let's end this and talk to Josh Mers.
Josh Mers is a Democratic candidate for Kentucky Treasurer. He lives in Lexington, where he has served in the past as the chair of Lexington Fairness, an LGBTQ organization. Josh is a small business owner and previously ran for the 88th House seat in 2018. And this is his fourth appearance on my Old Kentucky podcast. So I think he has the record now.
Yay.
So Josh Mers, welcome back to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you so much. And you know, if you're going to give out swag, I think you'd get folks to come back more often.
Yeah. But yeah, we do have swag now.
Yeah.
It's a secret. You should listen to the end of the show to learn more about
it. Oh, I'm sorry. I ruined it. Spoiled it.
No, you teased it.
It's perfect.
All right. When you first started talking about running, it was reported that you might be a candidate for auditor, but then that race got really crowded and you moved over to run for treasurer. So tell us why you made that decision and why you want to be Kentucky State Treasurer.
Well, you know, first off, I'll tell you that I actually nixed the idea of auditor before the race got crowded. Now, I had some, you know, some conversations and some rumors of some other folks that were going to be getting in that race. But at the time that I filed for treasurer, there was still only one person in the auditor's race.
Right.
Both positions are extremely important and vital for state government and for the taxpayers. And the auditor is a special position that gets to be the watchdog after the fact. They get to find when corruption or fraud has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the important part of the treasurer is they're supposed to find it before it happens. And they need to be working to prevent the fraud, prevent the corruption. And both positions serve these vital roles for the taxpayer. And as far as, you know, why, you know, looking at both races initially, you know, thought auditor might be a good role. But then I realized that treasurer was going to be the one that best suited, you know, my background, that I would be able to offer the best in service to the people of Kentucky.
But there are some people that would say that the treasurer doesn't actually do anything.
Well, that's because we've had a really bad problem over the last several years of the folks that are running for treasurer and the folks that are serving as treasurer for making sure that the people of Kentucky know why the position is important.
Right. So you tell us.
Well, you know, I mean, there are certain statutory requirements that the treasurer has to do. And of course, the easiest one to know is balance the checkbook. Mm-hmm. Monitor the deposits, monitor what we're writing checks out for. Of course, there's unclaimed property, and you hear a lot about that. And it seems like this, you know, this gorilla or elephant in the room that, you know, nobody really wants to make efficient and effective. But it's really important because this is stuff that belongs to the people of Kentucky that the state's holding. And we've got to do a really good job, again, be efficient and effective about getting that property back into the hands of the people that it belongs to. The third avenue is of course, the financial literacy aspect. You know, the treasurer is tasked with trying to improve the financial literacy for varying groups of people in the Commonwealth. And we're just simply not doing a good enough job of making sure that our kids are prepared to be adults. You know, you see the memes on the internet and everything where they talk about that, you know, I know how to do algebra and I know how to do geometry, but, you know, goodness, writing a check or knowing what a credit score is, opening a checking account, don't know anything about right. that. And we've got to do a better job of that.
So, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But there are several people who've kind of run in the past on the idea of, like, eliminating the office. And I think that that's probably because a lot of the people who've served in this role haven't done very much. And I think that leads us to the question of, you know, what are the ways in which the treasurer's office has been run in the past that you would like to see changed? How would you run it if you were in charge?
Well, you know, first of all, the treasurer has to be more than somebody that just hangs out in the office in Frankfort. They've got to be visible to the people of Kentucky, and they've got to be explaining why it's important that, you know, that the boards that the treasurer sits on, why those are important, why they have a very powerful voice in affecting change. They've also got to do a better job of, like I said, making sure that people understand the importance. And the people that have run on eliminating it in the past just simply didn't understand why the job was important. And they tried to use it as a way to garner votes by saying, we'll just get rid of this office. Mm-hmm. We've had treasurers in the past that were very effective and definitely use the pulpit of the statewide office to create change or to create good programs that the people of the Commonwealth were able to benefit off of. You know, a great example, Jonathan Miller with the college savings plans was huge. And that's what we need is a proactive treasurer that's willing to go out and use that pulpit of the statewide office to advocate for the things that the Kentucky taxpayers need.
Switching gears a little bit, Kentucky has never had a statewide elected official who openly identified as LGBTQ. In fact, there's really only a small handful of elected officials at all across the state. We've heard you speak before about the importance of representation in marginalized communities. What would it mean to you to be the first statewide LGBTQ elected official in our Commonwealth?
Well, I don't think it's as important as what it would mean to me. It's much more important for what it would mean to that young LGBT kid that's growing up anywhere in this Commonwealth.
Right.
You know, one of the great things that we see when we have representatives that reflect the people of the Commonwealth, that are female, that are mm-hmm. minority, that are, you know, LGBT, is that it tells the kid that's growing up in Simpson County, Kentucky, which is where I'm from, mm-hmm. that you can do something. You can do something. And I had people, you know, as a young kid, I loved politics. You know, I was that little kid that was a nerd about politics. I just loved it. And I'll never forget having a conversation with somebody that was very close and dear to me that when I actually came out said, well, you'll never be successful in politics. Mm-hmm. And that's the wrong message. And by having folks, you know, seeing Jim Gray as the openly out mayor of Lexington mm-hmm. for the last 8 years was huge for young LGBT kids to see that they can accomplish that. You know, it's important because the statistics also show us that states that have low LGBT representation have very low equality scores. And I can't reveal the number that Chris Hartman over the Fairness Campaign, you know, that we've seen so far, but the Kentucky equality score, you know, it's less than the Super Bowl total score. It's awful.
So not high.
It's not high at all.
There was a vote in Somerset, I think, this week that didn't go very well either. It's something that certainly still plagues Kentucky. Absolutely.
It is. And, you know, we've got to get there. It's just, you know, it's not a matter of trying to, you know, talk about religious values or trying to talk about, you know, harming business. It's a matter of just doing what's right. And, you know, Kentucky was one of the first states in the South, if not the first state in the South, to pass its own Civil Rights Act. And they did that in Frankfort because they knew that they weren't going to pass it in every little map dot across Kentucky. It was going to take mm-hmm. them having the courage to do what was right in Frankfort. And when it comes to that statewide fairness ordinance, you know, and I'll plug that right here, 21 co-sponsors in the State House. It's the most ever.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's great to see that change. And we're going to get there. Yeah. You know, when that happens, I don't know. But we're going to get there at some point when Kentucky is a welcoming and fair place for everybody that lives in the state.
Right. The sponsors certainly show some progress on that issue. Specifically, I mean, just geography based. I think that for the longest time, it was only Lexington and Louisville that had any co-sponsors. And now you're starting to see people, Patty Minter of Bowling Green, you know, as one of the chief sponsors on the whole bill.
Well, and, you know, Patty ran openly saying she was going to support that bill. I think the one that is even more kind of, I don't know if courageous is the right word, but more monumental in this case is Dennis Keene up in Northern Kentucky. He's been there for a long time. This is his first time ever signing on as a co-sponsor. And I think that says a lot that we're making some inroads into Northern Kentucky as well.
Yeah, I think a statewide elected official in the LGBT community would be another big way to show that we're serious about this.
You know, I think it would be. I do. I think it's important. You know, I think, you know, we've got an openly LGBT person, the mayor of South Bend, that's running for president now. Mm-hmm. You know, what his chances are, I don't know. But I think it sends the right message to those young kids that, like myself, that grew up in rural Kentucky that didn't see themselves in their elected officials.
Mm-hmm. All right, switching gears again, just a little bit. Running for a statewide election in Kentucky is very interesting because it's an odd-numbered year. And not only are people already kind of there isn't a big race like a Senate race or a presidential race to bring people out to the polls. You're mostly voting on statewide stuff. But even then, the governor's race has really started to dominate all of the conversations around our statewide elections. Is there something more to running for a down ballot race like treasurer than like hope your gubernatorial candidate wins and then pray?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, first of all, I'm going to correct you on one part. There is the biggest race that Kentuckians to date have ever seen, and that is the governor's race.
Right.
We have a governor that, you know, his ideology is just, it's wrong. And we've got to win it for the sake of the future of the Commonwealth. Which obviously you can tell by that any statewide ballot race is really heavily dependent on the top of the ticket. Mm-hmm. Unless you've got $1 million and name ID that's already in the 60 or 70 points, you know, you're going to depend on how well the top of the ticket turns out. You know, what you are able to do in those down ballot races is to try to energize. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that the treasurer's race is the most exciting one to talk about. I know it's not. It's important. We've got to do a real good job of showing why it's important. But we've got the ability to go in and try to, you know, maybe bring along some folks that, you know, that otherwise aren't as excited about the governor's race. And that's, you know, that's another part of when you bring in the identity politics, that helps to motivate people that otherwise would not participate in what's going to be or has traditionally been a very low turnout race.
Right. I am kind of interested. So, you mentioned your background as somebody from Simpson County. You also hail from Lexington. That's where you make your home. How do you go about campaigning for an office like this? Is this like something that you're going to be barnstorming the whole state? I mean, or is it something you kind of do from, you obviously have to, you know, also make a living and do a job and stuff. So how are you managing to do a campaign?
We've got 97 days. And the reality is that, you know, while you would love to be able to go to all 120 counties, mm-hmm. It's very tough.
Sure.
It's tough to get to a place like Fulton County that from Lexington is probably a 5.5 to 6 hour drive. Mm-hmm. You do spend a lot of time going to every little place. A couple of weeks ago, I guess right after I filed, one of the first places I went to was a Pizza Hut in a small rural part of Kentucky, and it was a county Democratic meetup. But it was great. It was great to see probably 30 or 40 people at that event.
Wow.
That they were energized. They're ready for 2019. But it is a lot of getting around. You know, there's a lot of, you know, modern campaign as far as social media, digital media.
I saw your video today. It was very good.
Thank you.
I asked somebody else too who didn't know you, and they said it was good as well. So there you go.
Well, that video was probably the bane of my existence over the last 3 weeks as we were trying to produce it. But I was glad the way it turned out. We had some great folks working on that, and you know, hopefully it sends the message that I want people to know that we have a problem in the Democratic Party of often saying that, you know, I started off poor. I was born to a poor working class family, and look at what I've achieved now. Look at everything I've got now. You can do it too if you work really hard. And there's a problem with that because the vast majority of Kentucky is still, you know, they're not achieving this massive wealth. They're still working hard. They're still raising their kids. They're still worried about public education. And they're still trying to do the best that they can for their family. And it was important that folks know that, you know, I'm not a wealthy person. I have a small business that by all definition is as small as it can be. I have one employee who hates the fact that I'm running for office again because that means that he's always answering the phone saying, no, Josh isn't here. But it's important that we make sure that message remains that we're still, you know, the Democratic Party is not just an elitist part of Louisville or Lexington, that we're still just like average Kentuckians. Mm-hmm.
So we need to get away from the bootstrappiness, right?
I think a little bit. It is important, you know, it's important to recognize that, you know, the Democratic Party, we have our base in the working class areas of Kentucky. That's where, you know, our original, our true support comes from. And the key is, how do we harness that original support while embracing the progressive social or you know, modern changes that we'd like to see, you know, across Kentucky state government?
Yeah. So you are in a contested primary. So I guess one question is, why should registered Democrats that are listening, why should they vote for you in the primary?
Well, you know, I think you're going to find that that first of all, I've got an experience and a background that definitely suits the position of treasurer. I come from a financial services background, owning a small insurance agency or insurance and financial services agency. I think you're going to see that of the two candidates, and for all I know, you know, what I know, he's a very nice guy. He's great at what he does, but you're going to see a very clear difference in what the two of us want for the office of treasurer. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want it to be just a rubber stamp, regardless of whether the governor is, you know, Matt Bevin again, hopefully not,
right.
Or if it's one of our candidates. I think that regardless of who's playing, the referee shouldn't be wearing a team jersey. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a clear difference in what I want to see about modernizing and making the treasurer a more proactive and crucial part of state government.
Okay, and if you become elected and you're serving as treasurer and 4 years go by and you're leaving the office, or 8 years, who knows, what will it take for you to look back on that experience and say it was a success?
That's a good question, and probably the first time that's been asked. You know, I think that if I can go to sleep, you know, that last night when, you know, whether it's 4 or whether it's 8 years, if I can go to sleep and I can lay my head down and I can say, I did something good for the people of Kentucky. You know, that, again, I made the treasury more modern. I advocated for fair and equitable tax reform. I advocated for new revenue. I helped to usher these modern necessary changes to Kentucky law while doing a good job as the treasurer and making sure that, you know, we're protecting from fraud and corruption. If I can lay my head down that last night and say I did that, then I would say it was a success.
All right.
All right. Before you leave us, do you have any thoughts to share with us on any of the other statewide races?
Oh, I knew you would ask that. I'll tell you a funny story. You know, so we had the Northern Kentucky Democratic Awards Dinner up in Highland Heights,
right,
at NKU on Saturday. And I got a phone call from the folks that were organizing it, and they said, we'll sit you with one of the governor candidates. Which one do you want to be with? And I was like, no, absolutely not. I don't want to be with any of them. You know, obviously the top of the ticket, the governor's race, is it's going to be an exciting primary. We've got three fantastic candidates.
Agreed.
And so in order to avoid being sued by Jeff Young, we have four candidates. Let me add that. But we have, you know, Andy Beshear has done a fantastic job as Attorney General of holding Matt Bevin to task. Rocky Adkins has, you know, some may say he's a little bit too conservative, but keep in mind what he prevented while as majority leader from coming to a vote. You know, and he's going to appeal real well to the folks outside of Lexington and Louisville. And so then you also got Adam Edlin, who, you know, I think he comes with a very progressive message. I think he's sees a, you know, a future Kentucky that would make all of us sitting here very proud. Mm-hmm. So we've got three fantastic candidates. You know, you got Attorney General, and I know you all did a big part on Greg Stumbo. I like to kind of, and Greg would probably hate it if I said this, but you know how Republicans hate Nancy Pelosi, but she's been there a long time and she knows how to get stuff done. Uh-huh. And that's kind of Greg. He's been there a long time and he knows how to get stuff done. He just knows how to get stuff done. I tell you, the race that I think is probably as vital, if not, you know, outside of the treasurer's race and the governor's race, the Secretary of State's race is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen what the Republican Party has done, like down in Georgia, where they've purged the voter rolls. That's a position we've got to hold. We've got to keep that. And there's some great candidates for auditor, too. So, I mean, I think we've got the makings of a fantastic slate that's going to give Kentuckians come November a great option to the current, you know, I wanted to say something else, the current mess we've got going on in the administration.
Yeah, you're running for office. You can't use that language anymore.
I can't pull a Ray here with you.
No,
all.
Yeah, right. Longtime listeners will know what that means. All right. Well, Josh Merz, thank you so much for coming to visit us.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. And, you know, if anybody gets close to four times, you tell me and I'm going to come back so I can hold that record. I love having records.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at forwardky.com/email, as well as subscribe to their other great newsletters. And finally, we have a Patreon page that you can support. And it now comes with swag.
Yes, it comes with swag.
We have stickers now. So if you are a Patreon supporter, we will mail you a sticker.
We're going to mail you a sticker. It's really exciting.
So support us on Patreon at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right. Guys, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.